So there's several different choices that one can that one has to choose from when implementing the concurrency control for transactional memory. So first of all, you might wonder on which kind of granularity you want to check for conflicts, and you have practiced different approaches to that. You can go either for an approach where you have your detection, for example, on a cache line or on an object. That depends on certain general ideas on how to implement your transactional memory system. First of all, this transactional memory system appeared in the contexts of structured memory, where you would have a lot of different objects that would refer to each other. And the first approach to something like a transactional memory system was one where you would take a copy of a subtree from your object, manipulate it, and then replace the reference to that whole subtree in one atomic instruction with your new reference. And that way you would have one transaction which would make your changes go live at a certain point. You could realize that with our wait-free instructions from early on, or well, with the lock-free instructions, where you could make sure that your original reference with which you were starting your copy process is still intact, and in case that it is still the same as the one that you had that you have based your changes upon, you would change them, so that you would have one atomic from outside it would look like one atomic instruction has happened. So that would be the approach that would probably go for the for an object or no, a whole object tree as granularity for your conflicts. And the other one would be the one for cache lines. This is another approach that came a little bit later on when it came to more general purpose languages, which were not so much about tree structures in memory, but more conventional variables, where you would somehow try to extend your machine model for general purpose languages to something that supports concurrency control for transactional memory. So in essence, that would be the realization that is in some hardware transactional memory systems in recent architectures, but we'll see that later on a little bit. So these are the two kind of granularities. And both of them would at some point create the potential for something like these false conflicts. So the false conflicts is, for example, something where you just happen to share the same cache line, although you wouldn't actually access the same variables if they still reside in the same cache line, and the granularity for your conflict detection is just cache line based. Then you would get a conflict and a kind of abort or rollback, in although in practice there is not really a real conflict. Then you have other options in context of conflict detection. So you could go for a system which is detecting your conflicts eagerly, which means that you would detect these conflicts as soon as you you access your memory locations for the first time. You could also do it more on a validation based system where you would not check for a conflict every time that you access something, but you would have regular intervals, which would then in the end accumulate in when you commit, you would definitely do a check for conflicts. Or, well, you could go for a completely lazy approach where the conflicts are only detected when you actually commit a transaction. Yeah. And then there's also, of course, different ways to refer to conflicts. So there would be the idea of tentative conflict detection, which means that you would also consider situations where you have a transaction TA that reads from the same memory area as transaction TB, which writes to that specific memory area, and although none of them have yet committed, you would always say that there is a conflict there and you would have to change something, for example, roll back both of them and restart them. So that's the tentative one. And the other ones would be the committed conflicts, where you would only go for those conflicts for which you are really sure that they happen because both of the transactions have tried to actually commit at some point. So these are different ideas and might lead to different actions or might be more suitable for specific application scenarios. Okay. So for the semantics of transactions, I guess everyone has at some point in his or her curriculum had something like databases introduction, and from there you should probably be quite familiar with ACID. So anyone who doesn't know what ACID stands for? Never had a databases? Okay. I would have thought that would be a classic one. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter because we have them on the slide anyway. So first one is atomicity. So that's the classic one that we have also used to describe other instructions already. So atomicity means that either the transaction has run or it has not, but there's no state in between. You cannot observe anything other than the transaction not having started yet or having finished. So that is the atomicity. We have had something like that, something similar already with our atomic executions. And they kind of the notion of atomicity here is in some cases in order to mark it as different, described as failure atomicity, so that it is at some point cancelled and restarted. But yeah, that's a very subtle notion, I would say. So, next one in ACID is consistency. Does that mean, well, this is about the state of your program, and the state of your program might make it necessary to keep certain invariants holding. So a consistent state would be in terms of the special invariants that are important for your application, would be that the state actually is keeping your invariants intact. And consistency in terms of the transaction means that the transaction as a whole is always meant to start on a consistent state and is always meant to produce a consistent state. There's no real description what happens in between. You might locally break your invariant during a transaction, but that's nothing that you care about too much in terms of talking about transactions from external point of view. Okay. Then, also, as such transactions are meant to be atomic, you only have these two ways of observing a transaction. Either it has not started yet or it has already finished. So that's the only two states that are really interesting for you. Okay, then the next one is isolation. This means that it doesn't actually matter how transactions are scheduled or whether they might happen in parallel or something. In general, they're meant to not interfere with each other. So, to not interfere with each other is the general thing for isolation. We will see that this is a little bit difficult to get right in every case, and there are different notions of interfering with each other and having them isolated, but we will see that in detail later on. And last thing is that the term of durability, which means that the effects are permanent. Well, we're talking about RAM, so, well, that's probably not something that's that will concern us too much, because when you turn off the machine, it will at some point lose all its state anyway. But yeah, well, as long as you keep your machine, well, the semantics for RAM is that the state won't disappear at some point. So yeah. Considering that there's no hardware error or some kind of hazard or something, then we'll consider that as being fulfilled. Okay, transactions themselves must be serializable. So if you run your set of transactions in some concurrent way, you can do so. It's not illegal to do so, but there must be at least one particular sequentialization or execution in sequence that you can that yields the same outcome for your state. So it's not completely arbitrary, but you can assume that there is at least one sequence of execution that will correspond to the results that you will observe in that system. Okay. However, that's still not sufficient enough to perform synchronization between threads, but yeah, I won't lose too much time on specifically that property. Okay, so concerning consistency during a transaction, because, well, from an external point of view, of course, these transactions are meant to be just one atomic thing, and there's no such thing as during, but for realizing these things, we need to compose them from different instructions, so there's, of course, during a transaction, in if you look at it more in detail. And yeah, what can we say for that? Depending on how you realize your implementation of transactional memory, you might still expose some internals of your transaction. For example, any of the lazy implementations of one of some principles. We'll just let the system run and validate afterwards whether some conflict has happened or something. And in that case, you might expose some internals of your transactions to each other. Well, that might lead to something like an inconsistent state. We have said we only have consistent states in the beginning and the end of a transaction. However, all of these systems have some way of detecting that there has been a conflict happening. And in this case, although we would have an inconsistent state somewhere, and our transaction might run into some problem because it would have expected a certain consistent state, some kind of property of our state. This might do something completely unforeseen, so it will turn into something like a zombie transaction. So it's, in principle, it's something that's flagged to be shut down, so it's in principle dead, but still running. So that's our zombie transaction. And although at some point this will lead to canceling the transaction, we still might have some kind of influence from that onto other transactions. For example, just keep in mind that, for example, you might run into an infinite loop which uses up a lot of memory and a lot of CPU time. Alone, if you just keep that behavior as the result of your zombie transaction, you will have some kind of influence in other transactions. So already on that, considering only these aspects of your zombie process, you will have some kind of influence on someone else. But yeah, in principle, we see them as zombies and will terminate them eventually. This might turn out to be something quite difficult, considering that you not only have the risk of something producing something that doesn't terminate or uses up a lot of resources, you might also touch a lot of other areas which then might have to be undone, and also might yield some unusual behavior in between. So, for example, in the system over here where we have two transactions, this one and this one, and imagine that they are implemented in a way that, or the transactional memory is implemented in a way that it actually exposes a little bit of its content during execution of such a transaction. Both of them, for just themselves, preserves the invariant. I've put the invariant over here so that X and Y is the same. However, if you execute, for example, in the sequence that you at first read from the X, and get some particular value, 42 or something, and then execute from the other transaction in parallel, assign 10 to X and 10 to Y, and then continue with this one here, so that we get 10 as temp 2, and if we compare them with each other, we get an assertion error, which might be something which is quite the mess if you need to clean up afterwards and cancel the effect of the red transaction over here. And especially if you do something with user interaction or with I/O interaction, you will run into a lot of very peculiar effects there, leading to some warning indicators going on somewhere and then going off again. And that's something that you should keep in mind if you have the internal state of your transactions exposed somewhere, especially if there's language constructs like pointers, and then your effect of a transaction might reach a lot of memory out there, which has to be cleaned up afterwards. Anyway, this kind of property, whether your transaction exposes its internals or not to other transactions, is a property that is not really covered with just the plain ACID. So there's this additional definition this additional term, the opacity of a transactional memory system. And such a system provides opacity if even the failing transitions are not able to perceive something like an inconsistent state. So still the failing transactions are meant to see a consistent point of view. So that's when your system is completely opaque to conflicts. Okay. So then there's the notion of weak and strong isolation. So the question is, now that we have talked a lot about transactions specifically, then we should probably also think about interactions of transactions and the ordinary sequences of instructions, which are non-transactional. So the question is specifically whether or how can we mix these transactions with non-transactional instructions. And, well, there's different notions that are out there for that. So you can do, for example, just nothing and leave it to no conflict detection for non-transactional accesses. So with something like that, you will get just the thing that you wanted to keep your program free of anyway, which is just standard race problems. So this will make your programs look like you would just not have these atomic or locked accesses at all. So if you just miss one of the accesses, you'll have weird behavior. For example, for this thread here, which atomically assigns a value to X, if you read it from somewhere unprotected with the atomic keyword, you will still get something which might end up with just half of the variable already written to. So, yeah, there's the behavior of something like that is just racy. So, instead of having no conflict detection, there's also the notion of transactional memory system having the more stronger notion of isolation. You could, for example, define your isolation in a way that it behaves similar to a system that would globally lock your complete program as when during your execution of an atomic block. This is a pretty strong relation, and this would kind of isolate the access to variables from transactional parts of your program and non-transactional parts of your program. So that's what is called the single lock atomicity. That is a model which would conceptually define your semantics in a way that as if there would be a global lock that keeps all your transactions separate from all the rest. Okay, so that is some kind of statement, like we have had them in the very beginning with sequential consistency. So it's about program equivalence. Something behaves as if some other condition would be valid. What are the properties of single lock atomicity? Well, first of all, it does the job. It enforces an order between the transactional memory accesses and the non-transactional memory accesses. So, so far, that's fine. This guarantees the strong isolation that we want to have in a practical transactional memory system. Also, you've got the freedom to optimize as well from the point of view of a compiler. You would like to reorder the instructions that are within such a block. Also, there's the behavior that we had with caches and buffers and all that. So this is something that's still desirable. However, with certain boundaries, like having this the transaction be isolated from other transactions and non-transactional memory. So this single lock atomicity still permits something like that. So there's still room for acting in parallel, so we don't overspecify the instruction flow. And so that's the reordering. However, what you get with that is also a very strict order between the different transaction blocks. So that is something that if you use such an atomic block, you can model something like a barrier with just opening a transaction, and that is something which because if you open something, you acquire something like a global lock. With that, you get strict dependencies between certain fragments of your program, which is something which eats into your isolation properties that we have talked about when we talked about the ASIC. So that's something that's not in every case really desirable. So what do we buy into with that particular property of our SLA model? Well, the SLA model in principle does what we want, but it is also very, very strong, in some cases too strong for what we actually want. For example, if we have something like a malicious transaction where we end up with an infinite loop or something, when we have a semantics that says we globally lock everything in our program and we enter such a transaction, we will then keep every other transaction from actually terminating, because, well, there's this type of global lock that keeps anyone else from doing something. Although, for example, in this loop here, we don't actually touch any variables, so we don't have any strict dependencies here, and this one should clearly be able to continue. So, yeah, that's the progress guarantee is influenced by our SLA model quite heavily. Also, we have this conflict with our principle of isolation. I've already said what you could do is we could introduce something like misusing our atomic blocks, our transaction blocks, as something like a barrier, so that if we have something like this, then we will have the guarantee over here in thread 2. If we read from our data here and then get descheduled, we'll get the guarantee that the program in thread 1 won't progress over to the area after the atomic, because this is with a global lock, we will this will act as a barrier. We can't take the lock in thread one also. So in this case, we can Well, that can be something that is desired, but in general, this is something that interferes with our property of strong isolation. So what would be other possibilities to define our model? Well, there's the notion of the transactional sequential consistency. So that is reverting a little bit back to what we've heard already for just general correctness of concurrent programs with sequential consistency. And in some ways, this is weaker than our global single lock atomicity. And transactional sequential consistency is defined that this is the model in which the accesses within each transaction are sequentially consistent. Well, that doesn't say too much about the relations between the different transactions, as long as internally for each of the transactions we still can make sure that everything behaves sequentially consistent. This has two specific aspects that we need to look at. In some sense, the transactional sequential consistency is a weaker model than the single lock atomicity. It gives strong isolation, but as long as we keep sequential consistency within one of our transactions, we could schedule another one in parallel, and this wouldn't hurt anyone. So we could, for example, if you look closer to that, we could move this transaction over here to act in parallel to the other one, because they have a structure that they that doesn't interleave, and we would still be sequentially consistent. However, we would have achieved some kind of parallelism in there. However, we would still keep the interference between the different transactions from happening, since we would require our transactions to still be sequential consistent, which they wouldn't be if there would be some interferences. So that's quite nice. However, with that, we also get some a stronger notion of TSC, which would be that before, when we had this model with a global lock, we would still be able to internally, within one of the transactions, be able to optimize, to reorder our stores and our reads in ways that are convenient for us. So with that, we would go back to sequential consistency within a transaction, which is kind of a stronger requirement that we had before. So, yeah, there's no reordering within transactions. Yeah, actually, in practical systems, the model which is used mostly is the one that we know from transactional sequential consistency. However, it is relaxed a little bit to allow a few optimizations that make race-free reorderings and buffers okay. However, I don't want to go too much into details from that. Yes? Sorry, that was quite fast.
You say that accesses within one transaction may not be reordered. Does that count for each transaction individually?
Yes.
Or does that count among transactions which happen in parallel? The same transaction might change things that for the parallel processes changes the situation. so that each instruction should be done parallel and they should remain in step and not one do a few ahead. And some the system has changed, and then the other processes do the same, but they're doing it on changed data since one process already changed the data.
I think you lost me somewhere in the steps, but you're referring to some quite difficult interaction between several transactions.
When they go in parallel.
Yeah.
It's the not ordering, not reordering. It counts also when they execute parallel. Should also every execution of a of access of a variable be ordered among the parallel processes, or is it just within?
I think it's just within one process.
Can they not break each other then?
Well, as this sequential consistency is defined from a point of view of one single transition, I'm actually not sure whether. Well, maybe you can construct something where there would be, but in these cases, by definition, you would just exclude these situations from being allowed to happen. So, yeah, you really want to have this sequential consistency for each of the transactions by themselves. So, if there are some interactions, I have not really thought about whether there are possible interactions.
But they're not allowed.
They wouldn't be allowed. Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It would actually be interesting whether you could find something that's anyway, but the general idea would be to have each of them locally for just one transaction being sequentially consistent. Okay. Good. So, now that we have had a lot of properties of transactional memory and of design choices and hazards and conflicts and the general correctness model, let's have a look at how you would kind of try to realize such a system, how you would implement a transactional memory system. So what would clearly be necessary for such a system is that you would in some way need to track accesses to variables between the block boundaries of your transaction. So, if we would follow the implementations that came out first, then there would have been something like library implementations of transactional memory. For those implementations, there are certain offerings of procedures which you would have to call, which would have to act as callbacks for the particular actions like reading from a certain variable and writing to a certain memory area. So the idea would have been first manually and then by implementing something like a precompiler to translate our very abstract formalism of this atomic block into something like a do-while loop, where we would mark the beginning of our loop with start of the transaction, and keep repeating this body. Well, that was not very good. Keep repeating the loop body until the commit is actually valid. So this commit would have some return value telling you whether it was successful or not. And the code that was originally found over here would go in there. And within the code, you would replace the every occurrence of a read access to a variable with the read with transaction tracking enabled, and every write access to some location you would replace with this procedure that performs the write and keeps track with respect to our transactions. So these would be the early beginnings of translating our atomic blocks. This is, we've already said that. Something that was done with preprocessors in the early days. And you can do a lot of optimization there by analyzing the code that you have to do in a transactional way, so that you determine just a very small set of actions that you need to be dealt with in a transactional way. You could try to keep variables that wouldn't appear somewhere else and wouldn't be accessed with another thread. You would, for example, not at all try to incorporate them in your transactional memory system. There's a lot of room for optimizations on that. What is also in many cases quite nice to have is something like a retry, either as a keyword or as a library call, which would, for example, act as something like a break in a while loop, and which would reset the transaction to the beginning state, abort and restart. And so the transaction would start again. Maybe in the meantime there have been some changes to the memory, so we would have to do changes to the reset that is kept for each of these transactions. And okay. So, anyway, if we want, for example, try to realize our Q example from before once again with the preprocessor solution, everything turns out to be quite nice. You just have to add this atomic block in the code, and the preprocessor would analyze everything and try to replace the specific parts with the transactional memory instructions. And there you are with your transactional memory. Okay. Also, well, I think this is the one. The retry is the one that we have realized with that jump before. That's also something that we should highlight here, so that these are the two components, the atomic block and the retry in there. Okay. Now, for realization, how can one actually really implement the internals of that? There's different approaches to that. There's the one that came first was the software transactional memory. Such a software transactional memory system would, for each of the transactions, first create some kind of descriptor where it would manage the data, like what would be meaningful to store there. There's, for example, the need for something like an undo log. If you directly write through to memory, you have to undo the changes that you did so far. That's something that is managed in the transaction descriptor. There's also the other approach where you don't write through your changes to memory, but instead postpone until the commit actually happens. And in this case, what you would need to manage in the transaction descriptor is the redo log. So these are exclusive, either one or the other. Then what you also would have to manage is, first of all, the read, but also the write sets of your transaction, in order to make sure that you get all the dependencies and the versioning. And yeah, I've already said it. You need to keep track of read and write versions in order to be able to actually detect whether there's a conflict occurring. And yeah, that's something that you will probably do in some way by keeping a general timestamp somewhere. And yeah, as soon as you start a new transaction, you would give it a timestamp and then have something to relate your read and write accesses to, and most importantly, the values of your read and write sets. Okay, there are software transactional memory implementations out there, especially I think 5 to 10 years ago, there has been quite a lot of implementations of software transactional memories. That was the time where people wanted to have the next generation language features for concurrent programming, following something like this, the well-known LOCKS, and even that early, people were already fancying that concept of transactional memory, as it is quite simple for the programmer to use. However, even then, there was already the proposition of implementing the whole system in hardware. That's also one of the causes why at some point the interest in that software during software transactional memory at some point decreased a little bit. However, this hardware transactional memory still, in most cases, needs some kind of software transactional memory implementation in case there's conflicts. But anyway, I think 5 to 10 years ago was the glory days of software transactional memory, and from that time there's a lot of implementations which haven't really survived. And one of the few ones that actually are still available out there, which are not tightly integrated into compilers and all that, is the TL2 software transactional memory, which is a specific implementation that that has opacity, so you don't get any interfering between canceled zombie transactions and ordinary transactions. So you will be guaranteed to always see something like a consistent state. It's an implementation that has a lazy versioning. So what's actually used in terms of logs is we have the redo logs. So what we do is the writes are postponed until we actually have the commit at some point. And what we have is a validating conflict detection, which means that as soon as we access a modified address, then the system aborts. So that's what we get when using something like that. Also, what we have in that system is a global version counter. So that's a large field for a number, which is increased all the time when we want to access such a transaction. And so that's the global version counter. And what it also has is a redo log and a transaction descriptor, read and write sets in a transaction descriptor, and read versions. secure. So, for the principles of TL2, in general, this transaction descriptor is always this TX here. So, we keep in our transaction transcriptor the version RV, which is the at that point where we start the transaction, the most recent read version of the global, which is just a copy of the global clock when you start the transaction. Yeah, the yeah. So what we now need to have a look at is the procedure that we use to encapsulate our read. It was this read with respect to transactional memory, which would get as a first parameter the descriptor for the transactional memory, then the objects that are actually observed from the transactional memory, and the specifier at which offset we access the objects that are kept in transactional memory. And yeah, what we would do is we would, when we read into a variable, a value of our transactional memory, what we would do is we would first of all check whether in our redo log, which is the place where we keep all our fields that we have written to, we would check if the if we already have a certain if we have already written to the offset in our utility object here. If we have done so, then we would of course take this this value as the value that we have to report back to the read expression. So we would look it up. So these, it's a little bit abbreviated here, these array accesses are kind of lookups. They might also be some hash table or some other way to locating the specific things. So yeah, don't take the code too literally. In case that we don't have already some stored some value stored in the object's offset, we would then execute an atomic instruction. These are one. This is one of the very small ones, so we can use our log-free instructions for that. So we would obtain the timestamp of the variable in memory in V1 and have a look at whether the semaphores for, well, we will see for which we will actually need them. These are semaphores which will, well, they will at some point be used when we actually write down our changes to the variables in the commit at some place. So this is the place where we check whether the variables are actually at the moment written to by some commit at some point. So that's that. So these two are obtained. Then we retrieve the value from the object store and once again get ourselves a new the recent version of our object, and then we now validate whether what we have read here is still a consistent state. We do so by checking certain conditions, and if one of these conditions is holding, then we do an abort. So these are all conditions that are violating our transaction in some way. So let's have a look at them. Well, if the semaphore associated with that lock is taken, if it is locked, then there's currently some kind of commit taking place. So that is something that means that our variable is written to, so we will abort. Then the version of the object has changed in some way in the time between trying to read and reading. That's also a bad sign. This means that there has been some changes to the object, so that's another reason for aborting. And last but not least, there's still the possibility that the version actually remained the same. V1 is V2, so during a reading there has been nothing malicious going on. However, the version is still greater than the one when we had started the whole transaction. So this is a clear sign for that we would have assumed some older value for our variable. So in this case, it has been renewed since we started our transaction. That would be another reason for aborting. So these are the three reasons for aborting here. And yeah, in case that we don't abort, we can then add the variable to our read set then. Because, well, now we have touched it, we have to register that there's a dependency on that variable in the transaction.
Yes, please.
This one?
Yes. Because they're independently checked. If one of them fails, we abort everything. So why should they be checked on the same state of the object? If the object changes while one of them is changing, we still notice the change. So why is it not functioning?
That's a good question. Where I also can't immediately tell you why. I would have to think longer about that. I would like to take that offline because there's still a lot of things to do. But maybe remind me afterwards, and I'll write that down, and we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
So I don't have the real reason right here. I would have to think about that. I think we need to progress. But good question. This might be related to when the version actually changes and whether this has been in a locked way or I don't know exactly, but I'm sure that one can find a meaning for that. Okay, so for the write transaction, well, this seems to be quite short. I haven't actually looked in them. I have taken the version here for granted. So it seems to be quite simple. Add or update the location in the redo log. Well, update it is, well, in this case, we don't have to interact with the memory in any other way. And add it, well, for that way, we don't have to check beforehand. We can just take it from memory, so that seems fine. So, what's actually done during commit? So, commit TX was something that we have seen at the end of the transaction, and there's different phases in there. So, what we need in order to perform that is the descriptor for our transactional memory region. Then, first of all, what we do is for every location that we find inside our write set. These are the places that we need to write to at some point because we have done changes to them. For these, we want to obtain logs. And this is performed one after each other in this try-wait with the with these semaphores that we've seen before. So each of these objects on which we want to perform our transactional memory operations are associated with a semaphore that ensures that we, in the end, in this commit, are able to commit in an uninterrupted way. As we don't have hardware support for anything else here, we have to resort to our basic mechanisms of making atomic regions by locks. Then what we next have to obtain is a new version of the global clock. So that's the write version, WV, which we get with an fetch and add instruction on the global clock. And now what we do is for each of the red values, we have introduced an entry in the read set. For each of them, we check whether the values that we have read for them, these are the values that that have, well, we haven't failed yet, so we must have never encountered a version of our red variables that were later than our start of the transaction yet. However, before committing, we still have to check whether we have worked on outdated values so far. So what we check is whether the actual version of these memory objects are now greater than the read version which we have marked for our transaction. And if so, we have to fail. Now, after we have made sure that we haven't worked on outdated outdated variable values, what we now do is for each of the entries in the redo log, these are our changes, we actually write the changes back to the general object store where we have our common variable values. Remember that we still have all the semaphores of the interesting memory locations in our possession, so this is something that goes atomic. So it will happen in one go for everyone else. And in the end, what we still need to do is we need to write back the new version of each of the written variables and also release the semaphores for them with a signal. And that's what the commit actually does. So what it does is just it acquires a lot of semaphores, then does a safety check on the red variables versions, and writes down the values for the written variables as well as their new versions, and releases all the relevant semaphores. In every other case, it fails, and before still releases all the relevant semaphores. So that's what I haven't on this slide. So what are the properties of a system like TL2? So as soon as we encounter read access with a value that has version number which is later than the version number at the start of our transaction, we will immediately abort. So we won't, well, as soon as we are about to see a state that is not consistent, we will just revert back to the beginning and restart. So abort is what we do here. So it's this system which is guaranteeing opacity. So what are other observations? If we only have read-only accesses, so read-only transactions, as long as the read versions are consistent, we don't need to access the global clock. This is something quite nice because that keeps one of the performance issues out of the question. So with just read-only transactions, we will have quite nice performance there. Then what also is happening is that if we are actually writing values, the implementation still requires locks. So in principle, we have some bad properties, like there's it's possible that there are deadlocks in there. However, as soon as we realize that we run into a deadlock with our locking in the commit, we can still just abort our transaction, let it compute anew, and let the other one that has fought with our transaction just continue on. So we can, in this case, really delete a thread that is responsible for one of the deadlocks. Also, the other thing that we could do is we could also make sure that since the semaphores that we actually acquire are of a very special kind, they actually come from this management data structure from these memory objects which we want to observe with our transactional memory. And since they are all from there, we can make sure that whenever we run through them, we can try to acquire them in a fixed order. So that was one of the criteria that we needed to ensure that there won't ever be some kind of deadlock happening here. So in this case, we can try to find such a structure. Yeah. Apart from that, in order to achieve our correctness in there, we need a few certain memory barriers in the read. So yeah, that's a little bit of details. So that makes sure that we always get the right data from all that. And the last thing that we have is with a solution like that, as soon as we have writing values, we will always have to access global locks. So that might be the bottleneck for that implementation. But well, that's only one variable, and with our fetch and add, we should be able to implement that in some not so harmful way. Okay. So another thing, if we use such a transactional memory in general, are a few properties that we need to be aware of. One of the hazards there is, for example, large transactions. So if we have very, very large coverage of objects in memory that we want to do our transactions on, it might be the case that we always end up in situations where we need to commit and obtain the particular locks for this large thing and get raised to the semaphores from some other thread which is much smaller, and at some point will then just have the the respective or particular semaphore. And in case we win, we still need to compete with a lot of others for the rest of the semaphores. So large transactions might be quite slow to get through the system, if not straightforward, impossible. Yeah. Also, yeah, so that's probably something that we will, that we have here in this example. Yeah. There's also this effect of contention. So, yeah, but that's something that we have already seen with the access to the global clock. I think these are more for at home to read. I want to progress on to next topic. Yeah. The thing that we haven't talked about too much now is non-transactional memory resources. So if you just don't care about what transactional memory really does in the internals and just try to use your general purpose code inside the Atomic CPU, you will end up with constructs that actually are not really compatible with something like transactional memory. For example, there's storage management where you simply cannot undo certain effects. There's volatile variables on which you don't have any influence anyway. And everything that is related to input-output, you just won't be able to fit into a model where you can just abort and repeat. And so in these ways, you cannot really get the semantics that you would ordinarily want to guarantee. So you have certain options to what to do there. You can, for example, just prohibit the whole thing. Well, if you have I/O in there, in an atomic block, you could just refuse to compile the whole thing. You can, well, simply don't care and execute it, and in case that it gets aborted, it's just the programmer's or the user's problem. The executed is just try to execute it, and if everything is fine, just let it be. And in case you run into problems, well, you have to abort. And the other thing would be to just execute it and and try to kill every other transaction that gets into the way of the one that has the sensitive instructions in there. That would be a way to deal with that as long as they don't interfere with each other. And the other way would be to, well, if you start with transactional memory at one point, you might as well make your whole program language compatible to the whole thing and rewrite all the libraries around there to also support something like transactional memory. So that would be the option of just integrating that. So anyway, that's very pragmatic tips there. So yeah, in general, the most useful application for transactional memory is just keeping it restricted to real memory accesses, and in case that you encounter things that you cannot really handle, don't allow that. So that is the implementations that you see the most out there. So now that we have talked a lot about the software version of the whole thing, let's use the remaining time for hardware transactional memory, which is the most fascinating, I would say, of all those. So hardware transactional memory is something that was the goal for a long time now. And the key idea is that, as well, in general, it's having transactional memory support in hardware is something which is really hard to do. However, as long as you just limit the size of the transactions, you might be able to get a real implementation of your transactional memory in hardware. And for that, you would have to introduce new hardware components for tracking read and write sets. And the important basic principle for transactional memory would be to use caches for conflict detection. So if you resort to these caches, you can perform your conflict detection quite in a cheap way by just introducing another flag for whether this cache line is taking part into a transition into a transaction or not. And if another thread tries to write to data that you have in your transaction, it needs to send an invalidate message to your locally stored member of a transaction. So it has to send that invalidate message to that specific cache line that belongs to that memory section. And this is something that you can detect quite easily. In this case, you would abort because someone else is generating a newer version of your already read cache line. The other situation would be that the cache line in the write set must be written back at some point. That's also a bad thing, but we will see that later on in the examples. So the only part, if you talk about this limited size transactional memory, is that there's of course limits in size, and there might be situations where you want to run a transaction which is just where the hardware is just not potent enough to realize everything. So there's limits which stem from the fixed hardware resources. So in these cases, you would have to go back to the software version of transactional memory, and you would have to provide a backup solution for these situations. So then there's two principal ideas of implementing the whole system. There's the explicit transactional memory in hardware, where you would have to explicitly use new instructions to mark your memory accesses as ones that belong to your transactional memory. This is something like the software transactional approach with these special purpose procedures. In the same way, you would introduce special purpose instructions for hardware transactional memory. However, this is quite problematic if you start to mix transactional and non-transactional accesses. So that is the approach that I haven't seen so far yet. The other one would be the implicit transactional implicit hardware transactional memory, where you have markers for begin and end of a transaction, and everything that comes in between would be considered to be part of the transactions. And the opcodes and the instructions that are in between these begin and end markers would still be the same as the ones that we have without transactional memory. So these mix quite well. However, there's still possibilities for aborting an instruction in cases where you use principles that are incompatible with your transactional memory concepts. So there's these things like I/O with hardware accesses, OS calls, and all these strange things that don't really or don't only access your local variables, but something different. So, So this is the version that's actually used in practice. So Yeah, due to time reasons, we won't talk about the failed approach here. So that is something that has been planned in the past, but didn't make it into an actual product. So there's no actual hardware which we can use that. Instead, let's talk about the other failed approach, which is the TSX in Intel's processors. So there has been several attempts on transactional memory from different producers. So there's the AMD, which didn't make it into any product. Then there was Intel's approach with TSX in Haswell. However, they detected that the implementation that they did was faulty, and I don't know whether you have a Haswell-based computer over there. At least if you keep your processor firmware up to date, which means using BIOS updates or some way of software updates to your operating system, then you will have that deactivated at some point. The newer versions of Broadwell and Skylake actually finally implement transactional memory in real hardware, and yeah, so you can get systems like that. Well, if you have a 2015 published system, then you can have hopes for transactional memory in there. So the approach that they've gone there is the implicit transactional way, where you just introduce this begin and end and possibly something like an abort in there, and the system tracks region writes with these transaction bits and cache lines. That's what we've talked about already. They misuse the cache for transactions, and yeah, what also needed is you have to at some point make sure that you can revert back to the state where you started your transaction. So that's done with backup space for the CPU states, like registers and everything that's kind of volatile. And you need a counter in order to support nested transactions. And yeah, there's always the possibility that the space that they have reserved for the write sets and the read sets runs out at some point, and in these cases, due to lack of resources, your application might also be aborted. So, yeah. Good. There's two different ways of accessing this hardware implementation. There's a restricted transactional memory system, which is this RTM in short, and there's also hardware lock elision, HLE. So, let's have a look at least one of them. There's restricted transactional memory. So what you get from there is new instructions. It's the ones that we have already sketched out. There's xbegin, xend, and xabort, and also xtest whether you are actually performing a transaction at the moment. Yeah, xend commits the transaction, which was started by xbegin. Xabort aborts the thing. Xtest checks. Okay, so far we have already seen. And newer C standards carry with them methods that you can call in order to access these specific assembler instructions. And, well, once again, I'm on the GCC and Clang compilers. So what we have in these compilers is this underscore xbegin and xend, which are directly mapped onto the underlying instructions. And yeah, what you can see, what is done there is you start your transaction, and in case the transaction is okay, which is in this case the minus one, this will lead to the to kind of entering the transaction where you can perform your data manipulation, and then you would end the whole thing. And you have a fallback area where you can perform any action that you would like to do if the transaction actually failed. So in these cases, you would either have to repeat or come up with an alternative solution. So that's what we have to do. We have to provide some kind of fallback code. So, what are typical idioms that are used in these cases? So, first of all, we can consider to execute the code itself in fallback. But if you do so, you'll get the problem that, of course, if you fall back, you will interfere with your actual transaction. So this will interrupt other transactions and make them also fall back to the other version where they don't have any protection at all. So that's probably not a good idea. So in order to ensure that the fallback path is executed atomically, what could we do? Well, we have to provide some kind of software solution here. So the common solution here would be to introduce some kind of semaphore. So the idea here is then have your semaphore and do a wait and a signal afterwards. So that makes the whole thing more atomic, does it? So this now makes it interfere with the. So those two will have a conflict. In one way we are reverting to the locked version. The other one, in the other case, we will use the transactional memory version. So that's still not sufficient. What we need to do is we also need to make sure that in case that there's someone fiddling with standard locks, then. We will make sure that the transactional memory solution won't still think that it's okay to just go on. And the way to do that would be to try to read from the data field, which is actually behind the lock that we used down there. Well, it's sketched here, of course, with this mutex larger than zero. That is the underlying integer where we count how many times, whether we can still enter our mutex or not. So in case that the mutex is zero, is not larger than zero, then in these cases the mutex will be taken. So in these cases, it's not okay for us to just ignore everything and work on our system. So, but instead, we want to abort and also fall back to the solution with our mutex. That would be the idea behind that. Yes. Sorry? This is to do with this amount of resources that your machine has to do, and the approach wants to abstract away from that. So you can't directly say or make sure that the code that you see will be translated in a way that it will fit into. Of course, that's just one instruction here. So that would probably for sure go through the xbegin thing. But you can't always make sure. And also. That's the idea. You have the fallback path. If anything really goes wrong, if there's some call to something which you cannot handle with transactional memory, or you use too many resources, or the system somehow else decides that this transaction just is failed, you can, of course, you don't have to resort to strictly go to the non-transactional, but you can, for example, restart a few times and only then go back to the transaction to the non-transactional solution. So it's not always that, but that is one of the typical idioms that you have. So you almost have this dualism between a part that is this programmable for hardware transactional memory, and then the fallback solution. So anyway, it's still not really, for me it's not really plain that this actually works, because, well, we only check the mutex variable over here, aren't we? Because if we shortly after acquire our mutex, we are still doomed. Well, at least it looks like that. And yeah, this is why we have to have a look at how the whole system really works, but we're out of time, I would say. So we still have to do a little bit of hardware transactional memory the next days, but yeah. I think the keyword would be cache invalidate, so you can think of whether you can figure out yourself. We will have this solution next time, so cliffhanger, yay. Thank you.